Hi, my name is Johnny Gertner, and welcome back to Season 2, Episode 2 of the Cedar 60 Podcast. At Cedar 60, our mission is to engage with culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel, and today we are excited to have Dr. Glenn Doerr on the podcast to talk about the crisis in Russia and Ukraine. Dr. Doerr, thank you so much for coming on the podcast with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, we are glad to have you on. If you could briefly introduce what you do here at Cedarville, but I know you're also involved in other activities outside of Cedarville, so if you could briefly talk about those, we'd love to get to know you a little bit better.
Absolutely. Born and raised in the United Kingdom in the southeast of England, about 45 minutes from London. Actually, in a hospital that was the workhouse that inspired Charles Dickens's Oliver Twist. And so that's kind of an interesting part. But my dad is from the United States. My mother is from England. And so in a sense, I always had a foot in North America, a foot in Europe. We moved to Canada in the mid-1990s. I lived there for 10 years, just outside of Toronto, but in various parts of Ontario. And I've been in Ohio since 2006. And it's been my privilege to serve at Cedarville University since 2012. As you intimated in the question, I serve on Beaver Creek City Council as well, and have done so for close to 2 years now.
So if you could briefly talk a little bit more about what led you to studying international studies and world politics in general, and also how that relates to what you do here at Cedarville.
To go back to my upbringing, just the background was a big helper, but I was a massive fan of soccer and rugby, and both sports are very global. And it always piqued my interest studying World Cups and seeing people from different parts of the world. And it's really proliferated from there as I grew up, gained a broader understanding of politics. The IRA was very active as a terrorist organization when I was growing up. Margaret Thatcher was in the very, very beginning of her prime ministership when I was born. And so seeing some of those things up front, and then just growing up having questions about government kind of drove me. And then at Cedarville University, just the blessing of being able to speak to students, to the wider public, and to explain some of the more complex issues in the international arena has been a passion of mine.
Well, Dr. Doerr, as you noted, there's a lot of complex issues in this kind of tension between Russia and Ukraine. You did also mention that you like studying politics and government, not just in the international community, but also domestically as well. And there's certainly an aspect of that involved in this issue. But if you could give just a 30,000-foot overview of what's going on here. I know it's hard to give a brief historical account of, you know, centuries of history, but, and we've said that on the podcast before, but if you could just give us a brief description of the history between Ukraine and Russia that we can contextualize what's going on right now.
To situate ourselves, we're on the east edge of Europe into Eurasia. Russia is the world's largest country, 11 time zones, and a population of a little under 150 million. Ukraine is a neighbor to the left, a former member of the old Soviet Union that dissolved in December of 1991, and it has a population of around 45 million. So these are sizable countries in terms of population, especially Russia in terms of landmass. But the history between the two of them is about 1,200 years old. There was a territory called Kievan Rus that served as the cradle of that civilization of what is today modern-day Russia. And it started in what is now the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv and expanded outwards. The Mongols then invaded in 1233, occupied the society for about 250 years, and it was reconstituted as the Grand Duchy of Moscow. So hence Moscow being a central location, today the capital, but not always throughout Russian history. Russian history has been a story of expansion and contraction. That Grand Duchy of Moscow eventually became the Tsardom of Russia and then the Russian Empire, and became really, really massive. When Russia illegally annexed Crimea in 2014, for example, it brought the attention of a lot of people around the world. But that also wasn't the first time they annexed Crimea. It happened in 1784 under Catherine the Great, in what was then the Khanate of Crimea. So this area has been very strategically important, at least in the Russian mindset, for centuries. As I mentioned, too, it was under a country called the Soviet Union that was formed following the Russian Civil War at the end of World War I, formerly the Union Treaty of 1922, and incorporated just this massive, massive territory. I already mentioned that Russia is the largest landmass in the world. It was even bigger under the Soviet Union when you incorporate, you know, Kazakhstan, for example, which in and of itself is in the top 10 in the world. But that Soviet Union that splintered, it was in 15 different pieces. Some of the issues today really revolve around Vladimir Putin and his view of history, Vladimir Putin being the president of Russia, although it's worth bearing in mind that he came in as prime minister in 1999. So President Biden is his fifth American president, which tells us something about the lack of democratization. It's not impossible to win election after election after election. We've witnessed that with Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany that recently stepped down. But she always did so legitimately, was up for election every 4 years. There were clear and open contests. And she remains popular, legitimately so. Vladimir Putin, we cannot say the same. Even though there are elections that are held, that in and of itself is a podcast to show how that is not legitimate.
So you just talked about the history of kind of the conflict that we're seeing, as well as the implications of Putin, for example, and his current leadership in Russia. But as I've mentioned on this podcast before, and as you well know, I am adopted from Albania, which at least in some part fell under the control of the former Soviet Union. So this issue has real world implications, not just for the people living in Russia and Ukraine now, but also for the people in the surrounding countries, as well as people like me in the United States who have real world connections to this region and these issues. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the current issues starting in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea successfully, to my understanding, and how that kind of affects the context of buildup at the Russia-Ukraine border right now.
Vladimir Putin calls the dissolution of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. So not World War II, not World War I, not the Holocaust. I mean, you know, not the Rwandan genocide. You know, pick something brutal that happened in the 20th century, the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And so he sees himself as a defender of ethnic Russians broadly outside of Russia. He also argues that Russia has been invaded from the West on five different occasions. If we think of Hitler, but also the Russian Civil War, as we mentioned. Napoleon did it in 1812. But prior to that, the Swedish Empire in 1709 and the Commonwealth of Poland-Lithuania in 1610. So all of these figure heavy in that mindset. The Russian mindset for history is much, much longer than we have typically in the United States. We tend to be very forward-focused. What can we do today? How can we improve lives for our children? And that is a true strength of the United States. But it is worth remembering that a lot of people in the world look back and centuries, if not millennia. So that's a key part. But Crimea is, as I mentioned, geostrategically important because of the naval base Sevastopol on the Black Sea, which then gets out into the mouth of the Mediterranean and then out into the Atlantic. And if we think about how Russia defends itself and its naval ports, every other naval port is frozen, at least at some point during the year. And so access to Sevastopol is a big one. But Russia has been aggressive towards its neighbors. It engaged in military conflict with Georgia in 2008, effectively taking the territories of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and then doing likewise to Ukraine, Crimea we've mentioned, but also the two easternmost provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk, taking a piece of those. And so, you know, is there a strategy that we can understand for Vladimir Putin? All of those areas are either ethnically and linguistically Russian or Russian-allied. But both Georgia and Ukraine are countries that have pushed the envelope of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, membership. And it's worth remembering that Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the Baltic states that used to be part of the Russian Empire and then later the Soviet Union are also NATO members today. And so many peoples in Central and Eastern Europe that are freedom and liberty loving want constitutional rights. You mentioned you're being born in Albania. There are many people in that section of the world that just want greater opportunities to say who's going to be in power and to grow an economy. And that's much better suited to the European Union and to the wider West than it is to Russia and the Soviet Union historically. And that's the tension, because the West is expanding and saying, yes, we have the opportunity to promote the free market, to promote democratic rights, things that we enjoy. Our forefathers and foremothers have fought and died for these things for generations. And so it's a key dispute that helps to explain some of this.
So I haven't personally had the chance to go to Europe, but if you look at the economic growth in that region, especially in Eastern Europe, countries that formerly belonged to the Soviet Union, it seems easy to say that the economic growth in those areas is years behind what we experience and have the blessing of living with in the United States. If you look at pictures coming out of Ukraine now showing just some of the poverty that these people live with, I mean, I think Ukraine is one of the poorest countries in Europe. So if you could talk about how, from that vantage point, how Ukrainians look at this issue going on now, looking at what Russia is doing at the border and kind of what Russia's intentions are with this military buildup that we're hearing so much about.
Absolutely. The Soviet economy, surprisingly, did fairly well in the 1950s. And there was significant success and some galvanization around the communist model. We tend to just dismiss it in the United States as always bad all the time, and there's a point to be made there. But at the same time, there were real-world successes. But there's a limitation on a worldview that's flawed and how it can move forward. And indeed, there was massive stagnation in the 1960s. Very anemic growth in the 1970s, and then much greater stagnation in the 1980s, which effectively was the catalyst for the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And so many countries that were behind the Iron Curtain, to use Winston Churchill's phrase, were mired in poverty and corruption and just having to give stuff over to the Soviet Union. And so when the door opened, many of them just ran to the West, to NATO as a stepping stone to the European Union. And some cities have seen real progress. What used to be a very stark dividing line has become a little more blurred. The Slovak capital of Bratislava, for example, has moved forward. Areas of Poland, the Czech Republic has really grown. Slovenia has almost caught up the old Yugoslav Republic next to Italy. And Estonia was a leader in e-banking and e-commerce well before we got a lot of that technology as at least ubiquitous. That's a big talking point, because we've seen an enrichment in some circles. But your wider point is there's still two Europes. Yeah. And especially in a place like Ukraine, where it's been outside of the fold of NATO and of the European Union. There are clearly some very wealthy people. The former president, Petro Poroshenko, was a billionaire from the confectionery industry. And in any city globally, throughout the developing world, there's wealth that's concentrated in places. But the key is to get that and spread it and to build a middle class and to build suburbs and to build second and third and fourth and fifth cities. In the United States, we have this big, long list of just prosperous cities. And while some have faced challenges and been hollowed out by some industries, there's still a very wonderful standard of living in the United States. And I think a lot of people in Ukraine want the same thing. They look at it and say, how can we get there? But being just badgered by Russia so heavily is a deep challenge, especially if they cannot get into some form of free trade mechanism or bilateral treaty with the European Union, or to get into the European Union eventually. Those tend to be the catalysts for greater economic growth.
So you mentioned Angela Merkel, who's the former chancellor of Germany. And I think, as you mentioned, Germany has a new chancellor. And it seems that he hasn't been the most forthcoming or easy to work with in terms of the diplomatic efforts to try and bring Russia and Ukraine and some of the other German countries to the table. So if you could talk a little bit about the complication of the diplomatic mission that's occurring because of that relationship, and also talk about the threats that Ukraine is trying to address in these diplomatic talks and trying to work through.
Olaf Scholz is the new chancellor of Germany, and he's from the Social Democratic Party, and his central goal has been to reform a lot of the social aspects of the society, very domestically focused, wants to get rid of nuclear warheads. That was, you know, one of his kind of rises in politics in the 1970s. And now he's finally at this pinnacle where he's the chancellor, wanting to do all these domestic reforms, and Ukraine and Russia are foreign policy issues on his plate. And one of the central problems is that he's very close to his predecessor, Gerhard Schroeder, who was a previous chancellor of Germany, who in turn was very, very close to Vladimir Putin. And so, unlike Angela Merkel, who was much more willing to stand up to Putin, Olaf Scholz is really trying to play this middle ground and not trying to utilize the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline into Germany as part of a repercussion for any military actions on the part of Putin. And so it's dangerous because Scholz has not proven to be a very good ally at this stage. And like I said, he wanted to focus on domestic issues. But what it's done is it's emboldened a massive troop buildup by many reports, around 130,000 troops on the border. There are ongoing military exercises with Belarus that will last until the 20th of February. So from the recording date, still 4 days from our perspective. Troops have been brought over from different parts of Russia, including Vladivostok. So that's next to Japan. So they're deploying troops all that way. And then they've also brought up blood, extra blood supplies, medical units, medical tents, things of that nature that typically precipitate some kind of expected invasion. And so it's hard to know how this will go. Russia does conduct regular military exercises with its allies like Belarus. This is not outside the norm. They also do conduct annual massive exercises. In 2021, it was the Zapad, the West, exercises on the border with Ukraine. That is normal. It happens in a four-year rotation. But the state of things today is that there are, again, 130,000 or so troops on the border. U.S. intelligence has released satellite images early. They don't usually do things like that. British intelligence have actually named a former MP that would be a pro-Russian puppet president. And there have been cyber attacks, and there are a lot of just signs that suggest that this is different. But having said all of that, Putin has postured in the past, wants concessions, and arguably just wants a red line drawn that Ukraine will never be part of NATO. But that flies in the face of the NATO alliance and open door policy. And even though it's a defensive military alliance, part of the MO is to promote democracy and to open the door and try and cement democratization, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. There's a real impasse here, and it's a scary time because a lot of analysts have said this could be the most violence in Europe since World War II. And I lived through the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s, remember those well, and that was a very scary time because sometimes these things can escalate. 140,000 people died from 1991 to 1995, and then there was further fighting in the late 90s as well.
So the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who are the president's top military advisors, released a study, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs did, that said within 72 hours of a Russian invasion, potentially 50,000 civilians could be killed. And as you've mentioned at this point, it is unclear what the results of a Russian invasion could be or if one is even imminent or not. And it's easy to conceptualize devastating consequences. But what does the future look like from where we're sitting now, not just in terms of whether or not Russia will invade, but what we as Christians can do sitting in a faraway country, not totally understanding what it's like to have a threat of an imminent invasion from the standpoint of a country with a deep cultural heritage, as well as what the future of American policymaking could be in the region.
In many ways, there's just layer upon layer of complexity in this conflict that's difficult. Just centuries of history of this area. And then a desire to, on the part of Putin, to defend what he sees as grievances. And so for Christians in the United States, we have so much that's built in Scripture in terms of how to view it. And it's helped us with a worldview that gets around some of these ancient animosities. If we think of Revelation 7, where people from every nation, tribe, and tongue will be around the throne. Those include Ukrainians and Russians alike. Yeah. And we also have to think about 1991 as a time of change wherein Baptist and Pentecostal ministries have done very well in Kyiv and other major Ukrainian cities. Ukraine is historically the Bible Belt of the old Soviet Union. And so there's a deep and rich Christian history. Russia under Vladimir Putin has moved away from the atheistic Soviet era and has really embraced Orthodox Christianity again. And so there's a positive sign in that sense, but they've really clamped down upon any Protestant ministries in that area, which is very negative because it cauterizes the ability to simply read the Bible in one's own language and to really wrestle through Scripture. It's worth noting that there, in general, around 74,000 U.S. troops in Europe under just NATO assurances and on U.S. bases, and that number has increased a little bit, especially around 4,000 troops in Poland, close to 4,000 in the Baltics, and there's a good chance that a significant number of Americans will be deployed this summer to just in case it escalates, just to be ready. And those include people from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base just down the road from us. It's also worth noting that if war does break out, it will follow five domains of warfare. It's not just your historic, land infantry type battle, even though there are trenches, which is really strange to the modern mindset. But there's also the aquatic, the sea-based, a lot of naval vessels are forming in the Black Sea. The air is clearly a significant domain of warfare. The Russians still use attack helicopters. It's a leftover tactic from the 1980s where they haven't really updated. But then also space and cyberspace. And so if we want to think seriously about security and the future of warfare, this is going to be a case study because it was used in 2008 with Georgia for the first time and then again in 2014. But you think about all the tech updates and changes in 2022, the variables that we typically considered useful for measuring sides against one another, that's changing. Yeah. And war is also unpredictable. I've mentioned it in class a few times in the last few weeks. Just the Soviets tried to invade Finland during the early days of World War II in what was called the Winter War. And they were rebuffed by a country 70 times smaller than the Soviet Union. Yeah. 70 times smaller. The Finns were very well armed, 3 million. They were able to defend themselves very strongly. So all that's to say is warfare is very unpredictable. Yeah. And there are lessons of World War I as well, where We look back and think, oh, you know, they did all these things and they made mistakes. But life was pretty good in 1912 and 1913. There was significant globalization. The Industrial Revolution was moving. The middle class was growing in places that had been aristocratic for centuries. There was a real optimism. And then 1914 happened. And there are likewise dangers of hubris in our mindset. And as Christians that live in a Genesis 3 world and understand that, understand the problems of arrogance, we have to be, I think, at the forefront to say, look, this is a dangerous moment. Things can happen. Just because we're in 2022 doesn't make us magically better than people from previous centuries. We're not. The heart is, the human heart is in the same condition. And Jesus himself in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 said, in the end days, nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. We should expect warfare as a natural. We should also work to be, Matthew 5:9, peacemakers, for we'll be called the sons of God. And that's an active peacemaking, not a peacekeeping, kind of, you know, put up fences or kind of slow peace building, but there's an active peacemaking in it as an admonition for us as followers of Christ.
Well, Dr. Doerr, thank you so much for coming on today. I think Christians in America, it's fair to argue, in a common sense at least, are fairly insulated from the suffering that a lot of people in the world outside of America experience. And so this has really provided us an opportunity for the context of what's happening all over the globe, especially in Russia and Ukraine. I was wondering, I know you recently wrote an op-ed in the Columbus Dispatch about this very issue. I was wondering if you could quickly talk about other writing opportunities that you've had, as well as just talk a little bit about kind of the research you get to do at Cedarville, as well as any books or recommendations that you might have on this issue or on the global studies in general.
One of the great blessings I have is part of my job is to analyze and to think and then to publish as I see fit. And so I continue to write on these topics of what the Bible says about things like nationalism, recent book out on that called Patriotism and the Cross. But my longstanding studies have revolved around nationalism, conflict, political violence, and a lot of it is really heartbreaking. But then there are opportunities to write op-eds, to say something to a wider public, to do so on podcasts like this one or on radio or television. So it's a real blessing to try and break some of these things down because it's very complex and it's not clear one way or another how this is going to end. But I'll point the listeners to a book by Garry Kasparov. He was the chess grandmaster for the Soviet Union and has become an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin. He has a book called Winter is Coming that really, I think, highlights a lot of what we're seeing now. And this is a non-political scientist, but clearly someone that's very, very smart. And I think a very accessible book in English from someone that was born and raised and a darling of the Soviet Union that is now a massive critic of Vladimir Putin, a heavy supporter of, in general, of democratic rights and a freer economy. So I think of many books that are out there, it's a good one.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Doerr. One of our traditions on this podcast is to give our guests the last 60 seconds of the episode to say what's ever on their heart. So the last 60 seconds are yours.
I think as you mentioned, as American Christians, there's just a big insulation from what's out there in the world. And one of the beautiful parts of our Constitution is it's been imperfect, but it gets around the racialized old world way of thinking. Especially on ethnic issues. It treats people as citizens and then as people made in God's image. Our government doesn't promote that, but it's a subtext to what's in the Constitution. And so it's worth bearing in mind that the mindset is very different in some parts of the world. Even minor differences that we couldn't tell from the outside can sometimes result in the greatest bloodshed. And so one of my missions here at Cedarville University is continually to push people to look at what's happening in the world, because While we have some wonderful insulations from the rest of the world in terms of our economy and our security, as Christians, we're called not to put our heads in the sand. We're called to make disciples of all nations under Matthew 28. And so I think that's a key to really focus, to study, and to go if you get the opportunity. Even something simple, go to the Caribbean, go to a different city, explore this wider world, and try to engage as best as one can.
Well, Dr. Doerr, thank you again so much for coming on the podcast today. You made some wonderfully articulate insights that I will certainly be reflecting on. I want to mention that your recent op-ed that you wrote, as well as your new book and the book recommendation by Garry Kasparov, will be linked in the description below for our listeners should they be interested in listening or reading those. And again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We want to make sure that our listeners are subscribed on social media and listening across all major podcast platform. So if you're not doing that, we encourage it. And thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. We hope you'll join us again next time as we continue to explore politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Thank you so much.